It looks quite classical.
It feels so solid. It's so beautiful.
It's made in a way.
Silver.
I mean, it's completely hand-forged. The engraving with the thorn pattern that goes along each side is a technique called engine turning, which looks like Fagin might have had a bit of equipment like that. I don't know. And then in the end, there's a gemstone in the end of each handle.
This is True Tales of Luxury with me, Mariella Frostrup. Hello, I'm Mariella Frostrup, and this is True Tales of Luxury. In this series of podcasts from Harrods, I'm talking to artists and creatives about their work and their relationship with luxury. Today I'm here with the jeweler Stephen Webster. His astonishing work makes him unique amongst jewelers, featuring lobsters and skulls, fish and crustacea, and his jewelry has been called gothic, menacing and bizarre, not words normally associated with the luxury item that is fine jewelry. Hello, Stephen.
Hi, Mariella.
Welcome. How lovely to have you.
Thank you.
Come on in.
Lovely to be here. Thank you.
Welcome to Harrods. Stephen, your work's been called magnificently gothic, and it truly is. You know, everything from jewel-encrusted lobsters and emerald-studded stingrays to skulls and insects. How would you describe your jewellery? I mean, if you had to go, Stephen Webster, jewellery is...
I suppose I like it to be a conversation piece. You know, something that people wear and it gets noticed. Not just because it's got a big rock in it, but maybe it's something that people... provokes a bit of a question and, you know, I quite like that.
I mean, so much of it involves the natural world. Are you particularly interested in the natural world? Are you out there grubbing for insects that you can replicate in gems?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, it's a funny thing, really, because I wouldn't particularly call myself, an animal lover or anything. I don't really have any pets, but...
And you are quite sort of the metropolitan, you know, in your dress and your general demeanour.
I have a house by the sea. I think I've found the sea a place that I'm very comfortable to be near or on or in. Along with that, I've found, you know, that I can pull some inspiration for some jewellery out of. One of my points of difference is that, you know, I could look at a lobster, could be a crab or a shrimp.
Anything with claws, really, is that what you're saying?
And see a ring in it, yeah, or a brooch or something.
But there's also that underlying gothic sensibility, a sort of feeling that the dark side is never that far away. Is that something that you feel personally emanates from you? You know, where does that come from? I mean, I sometimes look at your jewellery and I think Aleister Crowley.
You know, it's a funny one. I suppose if I think of sort of like architecturally, you know, Gothic, and then I find that aesthetic is something that has always been appealing to me. It's easier for me to look at something and pull out a bit of a darker side to it. But I always feel it's got a sort of sometimes a bit of humour about it. It's not depressingly dark.
But there's an air of menace. Do you see menace in the world?
Yeah, of course I do. But people who know me probably don't think that I have a dark side. So somewhere in the mix there is, if it hasn't got a point on it, it doesn't quite feel like Stephen Webster. And that's kind of true. And if that then makes something appear to be gothic, then so be it. But... I'm not a dark person, though.
When did your sort of signature style evolve? Because I know, you know, as a kid, you're the son of a draftsman in Kent, but you were quite interested in things aesthetic, shall we say, and you found yourself going to Medway College, where you decided fashion wasn't for you. What happened?
Well, yeah, I decided fashion wasn't for me. And I think discovering jewellery was more about the processes that were involved in the craft side. I don't think I had any idea of what designing a piece of jewellery would have meant. I just wanted to be a really great craftsman because that to me is sort of 80% of what jewellery is. You know, it's about skills and crafts and techniques, amazing techniques. And fine jewellery really felt quite restricted and confined. And at that time, this was in the 70s.
Did it feel like there were rules?
Oh, there were so many rules.
Oh, were there?
So many rules.
What kind of rules?
Well, I think, you know, it was a bit like, well, you can't do that. No, you can't do that. I think it was all to do with, you know, it was just steeped in these traditions, which some I embrace and I love, and I've tried to incorporate all the way through my life. But I think there were rules that could be broken, and they were more about the way that you applied these skills and techniques rather than not doing them properly. You know, I always respected that you had to do everything properly, not like half-assed, but you could apply it in a way that changed the aesthetic.
Can you give me an example for the uninitiated like me, so I understand what the difference was?
Well, I can use an example because you brought it up about skulls, and probably going back 25 years or more, and I was really, really sort of experimenting with all techniques that you could associate with fine jewelry, and one was an intaglio. An intaglio is where you carve into a stone, and it's ancient. It's probably got its roots 1,000 years ago or something, and intaglio carving tended to be, the imagery was quite classic. You know, you'd get like a Grecian or Roman silhouette of a woman or a soldier or something like that. And that's what they were. So you looked at intaglio and you say, well, that's what intaglio is. But it wasn't. Intaglio is just the technique. So I started to carve skulls into the back of a stone. And, of course, that was something no one really thought of. How could that be? But it's still an intaglio. This was a reverse intaglio. So you review the image, in my case, a skull, through the front of the stone. It appears that this skull was floating in the middle of a gem. It's a great technique. And, of course, you can do anything with it. And I think it was things like that, really, was sort of pushing something and saying, well, this is the skill, this is the technique. How can I make it my own?
So you said that at college you moved from fashion design to jewellery, and it was about the sort of processes. What were did they feel more manly?
They did feel more manly. I had been to Gravesend School for Boys, and I was 15 when I went for my interview at art school. And I think being confronted in the fashion department by sewing machines and girls and a very flamboyant, obviously homosexual teacher would just frighten the life out of me. I think, so given me another 6 weeks, I probably would have been okay. It was just a bit raw coming out of Gravesend Grammar School. So I was able to look around, and even though the jewellery department did have a woman in it, which is quite funny, you know, when I think about the jewellery industry now, it's probably gone the other way, you know, where it's a lot more women in the jewellery industry. But then it was probably quite a manly sort of a sport, if you like. But the processes were quite grimy. You know, it was noisy. It was a lot of noise. There was a hammering. There was flames. There was smells. There was, you know, chemicals. And everything felt quite sort of robust that was going on. But out the other end, there was this sort of treasure.
I know your dad was a draftsman, we mentioned that, and you've said that he hated his job. Mm. Did that, in a way, inspire you to try and find something that you love doing? Did it set you on a path of thinking, I don't want to be like that, I want to find something I love?
Yeah, I think it did. I mean, there was other issues with my father. He was a very depressive person as well, which didn't help. From starting my apprenticeship, I just remember being sort of euphoric. I was just thinking, wow, this is how I'm going to make my living. And I couldn't imagine anything better. Yeah, I couldn't wait to get to work.
In a way, I mean, you then took a sort of classic course. You went to Hatton Garden, and then you worked for some other designer jewellers. And then you struck up a working partnership with a gemologist who sounds like he comes straight out of Indiana Jones.
Yeah.
Tell me a bit about him.
Well,
and that.
He was a very interesting guy. I mean, first of all, he was Canadian.
Exotic,
and,
then.
Yeah. And he offered me to fly me to Canada to sort of check out where I was potentially going to work, because this job offer was in Canada. So he flew me to a place called Calgary. It was January. It was like minus 25. And my auntie Peg had bought me a coat. I don't think she had any idea what minus 25 was like. It certainly wasn't something that Scott would have taken to the Antarctic. It was probably like, you know, something with a little fleece inside.
Nice lapel. But,
yeah, it was crazy. And I'd never been on a plane before. And we were in a ski resort called Banff, Alberta. I thought I'd been kidnapped at first because, you know, it was a long way from home. And he took me skiing. I never skied. To me, it was just posh people skied. And I went through quite a lot in these 10 days of, you know, should I take this job or not? Because, you know, it was obvious it was quite remote.
Yeah.
And I was a Londoner, well. But I took it. And, yeah, it was an amazing experience because he would just go off to all sorts of exotic places, because gemstones only come from exotic places. They don't ever find anything in like Croydon or anywhere. They're always in Afghanistan or Pakistan or Brazil or all over Africa. They're never like local. And he would go straight to the mine and come back with gems that I'd never heard of. You know, I mean, tanzanites and savorites and tourmalines, and they weren't the normal. They weren't in the palette of a jeweler on Bond Street at that time. And they were quite big and really juicy looking, amazing, you know, not your standard, you know, red, blue, green, white, emeralds, rubies, sapphires, diamonds. They were all sorts of shades.
So they were sort of bringing the world into your workshop.
And they came with stories so I was sort of baptism by fire, you know. I'd finished my apprenticeship. I was very good at making jewellery. I hadn't really had to design jewellery because that wasn't the requirement of being an apprentice. And then he would just sort of put these rocks on my bench and say, there you go, it's your turn now.
Wow.
It's quite funny because I hadn't got to the part yet where I was taking ownership of a craft skill, a technique, and making it my own. I was sort of just doing what I knew, which is what I'd been taught. So I was taking these big... I remember the first ring I made was this a thing called a... It was called a Malaya garnet, and it was a most incredible burned orange coloured gem, and it was big, and I tried to sort of squeeze it into a amount that you probably would have put a sapphire in had you been in London, because I didn't really know what else to do with it. You know, it was sort of bursting at the seams. It wanted to escape, but you know, after a while, I started to think, oh, you know, I've got to treat these a bit differently, you know, and I did. It was the start, I think, of me developing my style. And it had to be bold. It had to be, because the gems were bold. They were determining that this was not going to be something that wasn't noticed.
You mentioned that he, you know, obviously had to travel to pick up these treasures. Did that inspire in you a desire to do the same? I mean, do you travel around looking for your particular pieces?
Well, BA wrote to me some time ago and congratulated me on flying 5 million air miles. Oh. And I did at that
did
point.
Did you get a black card?
Yeah, I've got everything they can give me, I think.
I'm so jealous.
But it is quite funny because a jeweller only needs about 4 feet of space, and I've got 5 million air miles. He's like, well, so obviously something stuck with me from those times. And, you know, whether it's just been because I want to go or I've sort of chosen to see how the materials I work with come out the ground. You know, I was in the first group, handful of jewelers to get a fair trade gold license, and I wanted to know what that meant, you know, so I flew to Peru, I went to the mines, I went down the mines, I saw what it meant for people who earn a dollar a day, you know, digging gold out that is, you know, arguably one of the most precious things that we have on earth, expensive, and that didn't feel right. So I've sort of, you know, made our business, be as responsible as we can with the materials we source. And sometimes I need to see that myself. And some of that is still from those times, knowing there was this direct connection, you know, to communities, villages, and not just, oh, I get my stones from a stone dealer, which is very easy to do if you're a jeweler. You don't need to go to the next level and say, well, I'm going to go to Tanzania and go down Tanzanite mine because I've been told this is, you know, the safest mine in the region or something. You don't have to do that. But when you go, you come back and you just want to talk about it and explain what it's like to go down a mine and bring things out every day.
It's strange because it does seem to be the last Wild West in a way, the whole gem business. And, you know, I remember being shocked seeing this diamond mine in Namibia, and it was in the middle of nowhere. I wasn't visiting the diamond mine, I was sort of visiting the desert, but you came to this place, it's like a compound with barbed wire and searchlights and really quite terrifying looking place.
You've got like everything in life, I suppose. You've got these extremes, you know, you've got this sort of massively structured sort of operations, whether that be gold, diamonds, you know, anything that comes out of the ground, which would be like you've just described, you know, I mean, you know, high security. It's these countries rely on this kind of their mineral wealth. And then you've got what's known as artisanal mining, which is where people feel that, you know, when they've got nothing, they can migrate to an area where there's potentially something if they dig a hole. And so
really like the Wild West.
Yeah, and that's where you sort of see things that maybe you don't want to see, you know, and you want to sort of try to be part of something that could change that, which is really, really difficult. And it takes more than a jeweler, that's for sure. But it's just a reality. That's just life. And
I suppose you also have to have clients who care about where they come from.
Yeah.
And that's something that's changing now, isn't it?
It's very interesting because when I first became aware the way things came to market wasn't the way it should be, let's just say, was with the diamond business. And I think everybody became aware of it through the movie Blood Diamonds. You know, it suddenly is like, wow, okay, I don't know if I want to wear diamonds kind of thing. This is an industry that needs to be more transparent
and reform,
and take responsibility for itself. But then, like I say, on the other side, you've got communities and countries that absolutely rely on this. This is what they have. So somewhere in there's just got to be a responsibility that does all it can to police itself, or whatever external bodies do that. And I think that was, I say 20 years ago, it might be more than 20 years ago. Going forward a bit, when I got this fair trade gold license, which was about 10 years ago, I kind of came back and the Guardian actually wrote a diary piece on me going down these mines because they're quite scary. Nothing to support these holes. And I went 2 kilometres in and...
terrifying.
And when I got to the face, if you like, there's guys... They're very small Peruvian miners. They're naturally very short, hammering this dynamite into the rock, and then they retire back a bit and they blow it up, and it all comes out. And then the donkeys bring out these rocks, and you're thinking, "Oh my word, this is crazy! This
must
is like
be something
the Flintstones,
like, or out of Dante's Inferno."
It's like the Flintstones, and I met a lot of the miners, and a lot were women, and you know they're supporting their families or nothing, and oh dear, it was terrible. Anyway, so the fair trade process was to sort of try to unite communities to work together more to create, you know, something that's better than that. So after this piece in The Guardian, I came back and I thought, right, now I can be a spokesman for this because I've seen it, you know. But nobody took any notice. And my clients, even my clients, I thought, oh my God, my clients, they're going to really want to
come on,
you know,
board with this.
Fair trade gold. Well, that was then. I think now, 100%. If you're not in some way able to show that what you're selling is, you know, is responsible and sustainable, you've got a problem. So, but that's only been in the last, I would say, less than 5 years, 2 to 3, maybe.
Just goes to show the impact that pressure eventually can bring. So we've got the principles and the design and what inspired perhaps the design in terms of, you know, having to work with these incredible gems being plonked on your table. I suppose then what you need is clients. You went to California, didn't you, initially, and built up quite a good clientele there, I think, starting with, I mean, it kind of started with, but Elizabeth Taylor being one of your early clients?
Yes, that's right. I mean, what happened was this, the Canadian, I'll call him the Canadian, it snowed on my birthday, and my birthday is August the 13th, and I said, there's no way I can stay in a country any longer where it snows on August the 13th.
It's that just means wrong.
It can snow on July the 1st as well. So I was 3 years in and I left, and he got very upset with me. But then when I left, he moved the whole business to California and said, will you come back again? Oh, all right. It's probably not going to snow on my birthday, at least. So I went to California, and we basically, what we'd done in Canada, we did again, only the times were perfect. It was mid-80s. So jewellery was, everything was OTT, you know. I mean, it was all like Dynasty, you know, and shoulder pads and gold and stuff. And so I was right in the thick of it. And that really was an amazing place to be. And yes, you're right, Elizabeth Taylor bought a ring from me, which was an extraordinary thing, really, to happen. I there was no social media, so I phoned my mum because I didn't know what else to do. So I knew that she liked Elizabeth Taylor. but the ring was one that I'd made and designed everything myself, and it was a big, juicy chalcedony, which is a lavender-coloured stone and cocktail ring. And around the gem, I'd put rose gold and I'd engraved thorns and roses and put little diamonds in the roses. So it already had my sort of trademark, with obviously with the thorns rather than the roses. So it was just a big, fun cocktail ring, which is what I liked to make. And she just bought it, and then she commissioned some earrings and a bracelet to go with it. But I suppose being in that community, anything can happen, really, and it sort of did.
Making jewellery for such a sort of high-octane client list, you know, from John Travolta to Goldie Hawn to Oprah and so on, how much is it a collaborative thing and how much are they buying into your signature style?
I prefer it when it's not collaborative, to be honest.
Doesn't everyone?
if anyone's listening. No, it's a bit like saying, well, look, tell you what, I'll have a go at being in your next film. You can have a go at helping me with this ring. but that doesn't mean that I don't take on board if someone's got, you know, because sometimes people come to you with a really strong, good idea. Suppose it's collaborative. You should take that on board and you go, right, now let me take over, if you like, and interpret that how I'm understanding. And that I enjoy. I love that because a lot of work that I do nowadays, that probably my favourite work, is bespoke, which is partly where you've got to know someone, you know, a lot more than they've just walked in the door and, you know, I want a piece of jewellery or whatever it is. Because I do a lot of home things, going to someone's home, understanding what their lifestyle's like, you know, how formal is it, informal, you know, is this something in the mountains, is it by the sea, is it in the city, et cetera, you know. So I suppose in that way it's the collaborations I like, but not sort of getting involved in the design or technique because that would be a bit crazy, and unless they've got that skill.
Or like getting rid of the thorns and keeping the roses, that wouldn't work for you at all.
No, well, I've had that before, yeah, exactly. They need to move on.
And, of course, you've had this long relationship with Garrard's. How much has that, or has it, in fact, made you have to rein in your style to fit back into the conservative jewellery business, or do you think that you've brought them out?
Well, I'm at the moment, I'm chairman of Garrard's. I'm not creatively involved at all. I think my relationship with Garrard's has been a long one through my persistence, I suppose, when I was younger and still predominantly selling my jewellery in America. I would, on my way to Heathrow, you know, on my motorbike, I would stop at Garrard and sort of show the then managing director some of my work. And he actually has become one of my very close friends, but he would sort of look at it and say, I love this. It's amazing. It's beautifully made. It's, you know, I've never seen anything like it, but it's not for Garrard, you know, and I kind of understood that, but in some ways, I suppose it was the establishment. There was brands like, you know, a Cartier or a Van Cleef, but Garrard's was this opportunity, if you like. It stood for Britishness.
And you wanted in?
I wanted in. And anyway, in the end, I think just because I wore him down, and it was quite funny because his secretary at the time, she would make me wait with the couriers.
You were on a bike.
I know, I was on a bike. Yeah, I was with the couriers. And anyway, so he took me out for lunch one day and he said, right, I'm going to give you a show. So he gave me his one-man show for a month. It was amazing. And it was the first time I'd ever experienced anything like, because I had a little tiny, tiny boutique on number 1A Duke Street or Manchester Square. And he said, right, we want everything that you are in our shop. So they took everything, my furniture, everything, and created a little area which was probably very progressive, to be quite honest. From then on, my work was being sold as Stephen Webster in Garrard. Sometime later, about 11 years ago, the person who owned it, American, had asked me if I would sort of come back on board and be creative director, and they kind of needed something. It needed to once again establish itself with a clientele who was now different.
You mentioned that 1995 was when you had your first show at Garrard. And then in 1998, I think Madonna bought one of your pieces and wore it very publicly. Was the 90s a particularly exciting period for you? Did things go up a notch?
Yeah, 90s was a absolutely crazy time for us. It started with Madonna, which did change everything. Everything lined up. I was making, which some people said with some irreverence, fine jewellery that had broken a few rules. Like I said, they were easy to break. The industry didn't want anything to do with it. I couldn't get a shop to stock my jewellery. I had clients, but they were nearly all in America. And then through a fluke of circumstance, you know, Madonna ends up getting one of the rings that really were iconic to what I was doing. They were still a cocktail ring. I mean, my favourite piece of jewellery is a cocktail ring because it suggests a party, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's not a commitment.
And it's fun, isn't
yeah,
it?
It doesn't come with a husband or anything. It just,
well,
it's just a ring.
Yeah.
Well, okay. So, and she was wearing it around on her index finger and so that was already different. And then there was this talk of women's self-purchase. And I think it was before, for a woman to go into a jewellery shop and buy her own jewellery was a bit sad. You know, it was a bit like, oh, dear, you know, you haven't got anyone to buy it for
you. Bless
you know?
It, love.
And that's what it was. I mean, my God, so men controlled what jewellery looked like because they were doing most of the purchasing. And this was just this moment things were really going to change. And so having Madonna wearing this ring and then all this conversation going on about women's self-purchase and then this buzz just started. You know, American Vogue wrote a whole big article about me saying that was the guy who reinvented the cocktail ring. It was about women sort of empowerment. Oh, my word, it was lots of stuff that was coming out that was really fortunate for me. It never stopped. I was here in Harrods. I got a phone call saying, you better come back to the shop. So I said, okay. He said, Elton John's just walked in. So I walked in and he was there and he had his little dogs. And as I walked in, my shop could just about take me and Elton John. It was that bloody small. And he gave me a hug and he said, I'm a big fan. I was like, wow. So
me
am I. Yeah. Once it starts, it's... And so, you know, with people like Jennifer Lopez and Pink and Madonna and, oh, my word, it was so many people, just Ozzy Osbourne and then all the Osbournes. You just felt like you were the jeweler to these people. I couldn't help but think that because it just kept happening. So it was our moment, if you like, the late 90s.
And with all of that going on, at the same time, I think, you talked about, you know, your dad being depressive and stuff, but you've also struggled with anorexia. You've been talked publicly about it, which, you know, a lot of men don't. And so that's a pretty brave thing to do. Where do you think that came from in the midst of all this success?
Well, it was previous to that, actually. It was the some of the reason I left Canada was not just because it snowed on my birthday. I'd gotten myself in the right state. You know, I was very homesick. I was, you know, I was only 21 when I moved. I felt a long way from home, you know, because it was 6,000 miles and you know. But I took my job very, very responsibly, and I think that drove me a bit crazy, and it manifested itself with me with starting to control my intake of food, which I think is quite classic in a way. You know, I spoke about it because partly I'm not ashamed about it. I think at the time I was tricky. You know, my friends didn't know how to handle me, and I became very difficult. If you've got a guy and you're living in a place like Canada where people eat gravy bits of meat all the time, and you got to survive because it's freezing, and then you got one guy who doesn't and he's like fading away, they don't know how to handle it. So you start to become just awkward. And it was my friends, actually, because when you live in a small community like that, your friends are your doctor, your dentist, your lawyer, you know, they're all those guys. They basically just pushed me out of town, you know, said, you got to go, you're a disaster, get out of here. So I went back to London, but I took it with me. It didn't change, actually. It took me 10 years to get over it, but I lived with it. Weirdly, it's a bit like a functioning alcoholic. You become a functioning anorexic, you know, or you don't. Unfortunately, some people don't. It's actually very interesting right now because people are talking about a lot of, you know, mental issues and things, which is good that it's out there. I think, as everybody knows, you know, you walk into a room with a broken leg and then all night you sit down and do it and you've got something going on in your head. It's not so easy. So
you have continued, really, to kind of set the bar higher for yourself all the way through your career, you know, and you talked about fair trade gold, about sustainable diamonds, about, you know, lots and lots of pioneering moves that make life a little bit harder, but are clearly things that you believe in. And your new collection, Fishtails, is obviously set amongst the, you know, in the oceans. It's focused on sea creatures. And I know that that's actually now become another sort of pioneering moment for you in terms of campaigning for the ocean.
Yeah, well, actually, the two things that I've got going on at the moment that are, I would say, sort of have a positive association, the Fishtails and then The Last Straw. And The Last Straw, I was just about 1 year ago skiing, and I'd seen the Plastic Oceans film, and it was so sad. And the one thing that stuck with you, apart from obviously all the plastic, was these plastic straws. And now they don't, you know, they're just awful because they're sharp and et cetera. And we don't need them. And as in Verbier or somewhere, and everyone's sitting around with their après ski cocktails with all these plastic straws. And I said, you know, I'm going to make The Last Straw, and it's going to be silver. You know, it's got to be precious. And I'm going to put your name on it. So it'll be Mariella's Last Straw.
I really want one.
And it hallmarked, beautiful. And everybody at the table said that. So I want one. And so I did. And I had no idea what was going to happen because it's just been such a massive success. And because it's precious, it's not expensive. It's £145, but you've got it forever. And it's got your name on it, and it's silver, and it comes in a biodegradable pouch, and you stick it in your purse. And I love watching people get it out. It's brilliant because they're, oh, yeah, I don't need a straw. It was such a massive hit, and I donate basically the profits, to be honest, to Plastic Oceans. And they're over the moon because it doesn't stop. To say it's the last straw, to me it was a bit like, you know, you're angry.
Yeah.
I've had enough. And so, and it's quite fun as well.
So just, I'm going to ask you about your luxury item in a moment, but just before I do, I know that with Fishtails, each item comes with a sort of story attached. Could you tell me a little bit about that?
We didn't have a product that was what you call something you might give for a christening or a, you know, a child's type gift or that, but I had nothing. You know, I mean, you don't give generally something that, as I say, has got gothic overtones.
Thorns to a baby.
Rosemary's baby, maybe. Yeah. So I wrote a book called Fishtails, and it's in alphabetical order. So it starts with angelfish and it ends with zebrafish and everything in between. So each chapter is about a character who lives under the sea. And then I created the alphabet in gold. You get the book free with your initial.
Oh, your generosity knows no bounds. I want one too. That's another thing on my list. But let's talk about your list now, because I know you've brought along a luxury item that you're passionate about.
I have bought something that I made, And so shall we have a look at it?
Yes, please.
Okay. I'm undoing a roll here, which is...
undoing just your average Burgundy jeweller's roll sort of thing.
So what I've got is a
table setting.
Set of knives and forks that I made. And so this probably says everything that I've said to you about me as a jeweller. It looks quite classical.
It feels so solid. It's so beautiful.
It's made in a way
It's that, silver, obviously.
That you'd really struggle to be able to do in any capacity now. I mean, it's completely hand-forged. It's hollow handle. The engraving with the thorn pattern that goes along each side of the handles is a technique called engine turning, which looks like something that Fagan might have had a bit of equipment like that. I don't know. And then in the end, there's a gemstone in the end of each handle. I make these for families. What I would generally do is for each member of the family, the gemstone in the end would be their birthstone. There isn't anything like it. You can't go and just get that set of cutlery done by somebody else and say, oh, yeah, well, someone does that. I don't think anyone's ever done that before. This set here is my set.
This is so beyond my ability to comprehend, almost, in terms of just, you know, decadence, you know. I mean, wonderful. They're amazing. They're absolutely beautiful. And yes, I suppose a life where you eat with silver, with gemstones, you know, that designate your birthstone in them. I mean, that's just kind of fantastical. It's like something out of a storybook, not out of the real world.
Well, it is. It's, you know, I mean, nowadays, of course, people say, oh, that's very Game of Thrones. Well, of course, there wasn't any Game of Thrones when I did this. I chose this because it's a piece of cutlery or a utensil for eating is an everyday thing, and this is far from that, but it does the same job. So,
and you've made it very, very beautiful. I'm going to ask you one last question, which is just, you know, we're in Harrods, this sort of emporium of luxury, and you've talked about your luxury item, which really is opulence on a fantastical scale. Is there anything in this wonderful building that you'd like to get your hands on? Where would you like to spend time? What would you pick up?
Well, let me see. I mean, I sometimes do a bit of shopping here because my wife loves to cook and I, for some reason, like looking at the ingredients.
Well, that's really your contribution. You stand there looking at the ingredients.
No, I don't. I mean, last week I was in the fish market in Seoul and I get so excited about seeing these, their ingredients, aren't they? So probably would be in a food hall because I think you can't really think of Harrods and not think of the food hall because it's the most incredible food hall. I'm probably in for sure in London. So, yeah, I'll be there.
Stephen Webster, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
This has been True Tales of Luxury, recorded in Harrods in London with me, Mariella Frostrup, and my guest, Stephen Webster. Goodbye.